Hello and welcome to Korean Context, a behind-the-scenes conversation with the scholars, artists and opinion makers that bridge our two worlds. My name is Chad O'Carroll and I'll be your host today. Kim Jong-il's sudden death caught everyone by surprise, putting North Korea center stage in front of the global media just days before the Christmas holidays. Analysts, academics and business people who focus on the DPRK were suddenly called upon by TV channels, radio stations and newspapers to try and make sense of the developments during what would have otherwise been a relatively relaxing time of year. Being from the UK, 2 days after the news broke, I travelled back to London for my own Christmas holiday. However, knowing that a number of North Korea specialists would also be in town at the same time, I thought it would be an excellent opportunity to bring Korean context across the pond for a special episode on the impact of Kim Jong-il's death and prospects for a successful succession to Kim Jong-un. So in this episode, I speak to Aidan Foster Carter, who's a longtime career watcher and honorary senior research fellow at the University of Leeds, Andre Abrahamian, who's the executive director of Chosun Exchange, an educational not-for-profit that works with North Korean students, Gareth Johnson, a British entrepreneur who works between North Korea and China, and Marie Verdier, a PhD expert in North Korean humanitarian NGOs at SOAS University in London. Having been in Washington DC when the news broke and seen all the local channels go into North Korea overdrive, I was particularly interested in finding out what the media reaction had been like around the world. Andre Abrahamian from Chosun Exchange explained what it had been like in the United Kingdom.
I spent the whole day flipping through news channels as well as reading stuff online, and it was pretty terrible, which is par for the course with media coverage of North Korea issues, I think. Anybody who had been to... So TV news speed is everything. So they had to get people into the studio to comment. Most of these people had only been to North Korea maybe once, and in a journalistic capacity where they just get whizzed around some sites and argue with the guides for their 2 or 3 days and then leave. So those are the kind of people offering insights. And most of the familiar tropes about North Korea came out, and not much beyond. So you hear all the words that you expect, Stalinist and Hermit Kingdom and blah, blah, blah.
Normally based in Asia, Andre went on to explain how South Koreans had reacted to the news.
I think most people just quietly, you know, take the news and I say, you know, we'll see what happens. It's surprising how calm South Koreans are when these things happen. I was blown away after the Yeongpyeongdo shelling at how relaxed everyone was. I went into work thinking, well, you know, maybe everyone's going to be talking about it and people are going to be on tenterhooks, and nobody was. Yeah, so I think it's similar now. Again, it's kind of like living in California and waking up every day being like, oh my God, maybe the earthquake's the big one's coming today. You just can't. You can't live that way. You'd be stressed out constantly. So it's very much in the back of people's minds, even in a big news event, I think.
With China having increased its influence in North Korea significantly over the past few years, I was interested to know what the average Chinese person may have thought about the death of Kim Jong-il. Gareth Johnson, who's himself based in China, explained.
They quite often compare Kim Jong-il and... the current North Korean system, they quite often like to compare it to how China was. So they see it quite a lot as their past. Some of them, in a nostalgic way, some of them not so much. And I think I've taken quite a lot of old Eastern Bloc people to North Korea, and a lot of them do have elements of nostalgia and elements of things that they don't miss. And I think there are... certainly, that's certainly the way a lot of Chinese people sort of look at it. They do see positives and negatives with him and the regime and the current political system. That,
despite the death, business has to continue, and I was interested to know whether or not it was possible to communicate into North Korea immediately following the death. Gareth Johnson has business partners in the DPRK.
We have had emails. Generally, emails can be a little slow anyway whenever we speak to them, if whatever time of year it is. But in general, I've not noticed anything particularly different. In some respects, though, we've not tried to contact them as much as well, because where I might email them and ask sort of a relatively frivolous question, I'm not doing that at the moment either. But they're certainly in contact with us.
Andre Abrahamian, having heard back from Chosun Exchange's North Korea partners in under 24 hours after an initial email, was also surprised at the rapidness that things were going back to normal.
At such a sensitive time, I think the authorities wanted maximal control over the country, so their surveillance kicked into its overdrive mode.
Right.
And I think a lot of people were thinking it would stay that way for at least through the mourning period, and then possibly several weeks after that, maybe even longer. But the employees at Kaesong Industrial Park have already gone back to work. I'm sure that the border at Dandong can't be closed too long. So I think we're going to start seeing things relax maybe a bit quicker than we were predicting. It does appear as if, well, just like the grooming period was shorter, the transition period also appears compressed as well.
Yeah.
I think it's in their interest to show both outsiders and their citizens that things are going to continue.
But what about anybody thinking of doing business in North Korea after the news of Kim Jong-il's death?
Well, I think there's going to be the same challenges there always have been. We saw the Chinese government very quickly come out in support of Kim Jong-un and offer condolences immediately after they got the news. And I think that's an important sign to Chinese businesses investing in North Korea that things are going to stay stable. And obviously that's the most important group. So I don't think we're going to see a major change in the investment climate, which is already a difficult one.
And while it's certainly a difficult climate for investors, it's an equally challenging one for human rights NGOs. I spoke to Marie Verdier, a PhD specialist focusing on NGO work involving the DPRK, and asked her whether the death of Kim Jong-il would make things easier or harder for human rights NGOs.
I think in the short term it's going to be more difficult. Well, these human rights organizations are mainly either brokers or missionary organizations trying to rescue North Korean refugees. And every time there is an event in North Korea, whether it's the shelling of the island or economic financial reforms or other things going on, there is a tightened security on the border and on the Chinese side as well. The Chinese are very concerned that things could go wrong, and they are concerned. They don't want refugees in the country, so they tighten their security as well. And they actually have soldiers in hiding on the border, ready to intervene if there is something. So I think in the short term, it's going to be more difficult inside North Korea, but also on the border. But in the long term, it all depends on what the new leadership decides to do. So we can be hopeful that they will not be as bad as the previous leadership, but there is no reason to think otherwise, actually. So I think in the long term, it's going to be quite bad as well.
Having been based in South Korea for a long time and focusing her thesis on the religious NGO community that work on the border with North Korea, I asked Marie to explain how they were likely reacting to the death of Kim Jong-il.
Well, you must understand that there are two sides amongst the Christian community. You've got the people who are working with their Council of Churches, and that's also people in Canada and to a lesser extent in the US. And in South Korea, you have the Council of Churches, and they have been asking for peace. They have presented their condolences to the North Koreans because they have been working with the North Korean counterpart in Pyongyang, which is the Christian Federation or something like that. So they have not been critical of the regime because they've been trying to make peace with the regime. On the other side, you have Christian human rights activists who don't want to engage with the North Korean leadership. So for them, it's like, what's going to happen next to the people? I think that many people were actually praying for him to die.
Wow.
So they're quite, they must be in a way happy that he died, but there must be some kind of frustration because he will never be prosecuted for his crimes. And at the same time, people are still hoping that the country will open up so that they can go evangelize North Korea. But they are not favorable to engagement or trying to dialogue with the North Koreans.
Just days after Kim Jong-il's death, Kim Jong-un was put center stage by North Korean media as the great successor, despite being only in his late 20s. I spoke to Aidan Foster Carter, a longtime Korea watcher who wrote much about the transition from power between Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il. I asked him to offer his opinion on Kim Jong-un's chances at leadership in North Korea.
I don't rate them very highly in the medium and long term, or even the fairly short term. And I say that even though, as we've seen, the past fortnight, the first fortnight of Kim Jong-un's ruling without his father, have gone surprisingly smoothly. And the reasons I say that have been quite widely rehearsed by others. He's had almost no experience or chance to practice. So although North Korea did manage one transition in 1994, and although on that occasion too I thought they wouldn't make it, and I was wrong about that, looking back, it worked partly because Kim Jong-il he was in his 50s when he took over, when his father Kim Il-sung died. He'd had 20 or 30 years of active preparation, administrative, political, getting rid of rivals, learning the job, ending up almost as a kind of prime minister as his father Kim Il-sung increasingly retired. So he really knew what he was getting into, and even so it may not have been completely smooth, his takeover. By contrast, Kim Jong-il did not bestow the same favors on his son, Kim Jong-un. I mean, Kim Jong-un has only been introduced to the North Korean public overtly and to the world for just over a year, 15 months. Possibly he was chosen for the job at most about a year before that. So he's really had almost no time at all. And he's, with all respect to young people, for whom I have enormous respect, as a rather old person myself, he really hasn't had much chance to learn an incredibly difficult job. Perhaps worth saying here too is we need to distinguish the symbolic and the real. Kim Jong-il was both. I mean that the North Korean system for both father and son has sort of projects them as being the be-all and end-all. But for Kim Jong-il, the late Kim Jong-il, it was true. He was by all accounts a micromanager. He ran everything. Everyone reported up to him like a sort of fat spider at the center of a big web. He was the only one that knew what was going on. That leaves an absolutely enormous gap. I don't know who is filling that chair and those shoes. I can't believe that Kim Jong-un, whatever his qualities, which are quite unknown, really, can possibly have mugged up enough to be able to do that job unaided. Succession is always the Achilles heel of dictatorships. At a time like this, all kinds of rows, I mean, it can be about policy or factional or in the family or whether to go lean towards China or South Korea or anything, really. This could all break out, and it seems to me that Kim Jong-un is a very frail vessel, basically, to be in charge of all that. I will be surprised if he's still there in 5 years' time, or even 2 years' time.
So with several spheres of influence likely to be vying for Kim Jong-un's attention, I asked Andre to walk us through the structure of power in North Korea.
Well, the structure is basically the same, and I think what we're going to see, and most people are predicting, that the relevance of the party is going to rise in the near future. And it's sort of made something of a comeback in the last couple of years anyway. Kim Jong-il's preferred institution to rule through was the National Defense Commission. The party has some influence through their military commission as well. And then there's the government, which is the top of which is the Politburo. And so there's going to be influential individuals in all three of those organizations. And how exactly they align around Kim Jong-un and where like the real base of power will be, it's impossible to tell.
Yeah. And a couple of names that have emerged in the news a lot, and especially in analysis, have been Jang Sung-taek and Kim Hyung-hui,
yeah.
Kim Jong-il's sister. Just for our listeners, who are these people and what's their significance in creating stability in coming months?
Kim Kyung-hee is Kim Jong-il's sister who's married to Jang Song-taek. And Jang Song-taek is has been tasked with sort of the mentorship of Kim Jong-un. So he and his wife are kind of the, I guess, Pyongyang's power couple, and will be the most closely aligned with Kim Jong-un and his fate. There's the direct blood tie, which is quite important.
So their connections and influence does mean a lot for the success of Kim Jong-un. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing I wanted to say is I think what we're going to see in some ways is kind of the end of the Songun era. Songun means military first. And that's not to say the military is not going to be central, but I think very gradually we're going to see a change in the narrative about the national story. And I think it'll look something like this. Under the Kim Jong-il era, the economy wasn't the greatest. You know, we had to struggle against the U.S. imperialists and their embargoes and sanctions. But that's when we were kept safe. The general kept us safe by developing the nuclear deterrent. And now, under the new leadership, we can focus on the economy again. You've already seen it over the last year or so, much more talk about economic development and light industry and consumer goods. All those things appear in North Korean media much more than they did a couple of years back. My guess is that the new era is really going to have to show some kind of economic development, some kind of success, in order to inspire loyalty and trust in the people.
However, many analysts are predicting collapse scenarios for North Korea under Kim Jong-un. I asked Aidan Foster Carter to suggest the most likely form that collapse might take in the short to medium term.
Here I have to be careful. I think I originally coined the term collapsist back in the day 20 years ago, because that was my expectation for North Korea, and it turned out to be wrong then. It's possible that it could be wrong now, but the strains of the system are acute. To use the good old Marxist-Maoist term, the contradictions are many, and it seems to me that North Korea is not an exemption, or not forever an exception, to the laws of social science, if I could put it as strongly as that. And in particular, using Habermas's term, I expect a legitimation crisis in North Korea. North Koreans aren't encouraged to ask questions, but they do in their hearts, if not publicly, and the elite probably do in their own households. So the question, by what right do you rule, and what good are you, and what is the point of you, are, it seems to me, real questions. So how concretely might it happen? It might happen at the grassroots. North Korean people in this supposedly communist state have not yet spoken, but we know there have been murmurings of unrest, the redenomination, or really sort of confiscation of assets 2 years ago, did cause local protests. As I say, it is a sort of a rare opening and a moment where things are more fluid when there is a transition like this. I don't see how one can rule out indefinitely North Korea being an exception to all other global rules, that somebody somewhere in Hamhung or Sinuiju or anywhere might not actually say, who are these people? What have these people ever done for us? A Romania-type scenario. That's one. So the grassroots is one level. Perhaps more likely is conflicts among the elite. Anything from the different within the family. What about the brothers who were passed over? What about the unprepossessing, but I think quite smart, eldest brother Kim Jong-nam, who is in China and has China's protection, I think we can assume his being in China means he has China's protection, who's on the record as opposing hereditary succession? What about the other brother who was passed over? What about, I think perhaps above all, policy differences? There are sensible people in Pyongyang. There are technocrats in the cabinet who would yearn at least for economic reform. By the way, I think when people talk loosely about opening, this often muddles different things up. And I think some degree of China-style economic reform, which China itself would be pressing for, is now fairly likely, whereas the other thing that everyone would like to see, namely nuclear disarmament, is much less likely. But anyway, conflict could break out over those things. A lot of people in the KPA have much to lose by an outbreak of peace. So the famed unity of the North Korean elite, I forget who it was said that they quoted, and I forget who it was they were quoting, the thing about they hang together because that's better than hanging separately. That was held together under Kim Jong-il, but it might now break down if some people think that a given course of action, say the status quo, which is what they've definitely, you know, tub-thumpingly said they'd adhere to so far, if some people, reformists, who think that would lead to ruin, might finally break ranks. So they could be open quarrels between different sectors, between the cabinet and the military, or between different sections of the military, or something at the grassroots. Any of these, in my view, are possible. And then, of course, not to go on for too long, but to talk about collapse then implies a further unraveling, that this would lead to something that couldn't be settled. The nightmare scenario, I suppose, being if one or another faction, a sort of someone from the civil war, if one or another faction called in China or called in South Korea. And as a number of people have said, I think the real worry is that the US and South Korea have got one set of plans for contingencies in North Korea, quite rightly, and the Chinese have got a separate set of plans also that they're entitled to as a neighbour, and one really hopes that these people are coordinating.
But with South Korea's Yi Myung-bak now in his final year of presidency, and North Korean state media recently exclaiming that under no condition would Pyongyang engage with his government, I asked Aidan if there was any chance that Yi Myung-bak might try and reach out to Kim Jong in the year ahead.
No is the short answer to that. I do think it was a very, very big mistake tactically and I think strategically not to go ahead as the pragmatist that he claimed to be when running for office with the, I thought, rather good, surprisingly good deal that Noh Moo-hyun had struck with Kim Jong-il at the second Pyongyang summit. There was a lot of win-win, genuinely mutual stuff there, joint fisheries zone, a peace zone around Haeju. Instead of firefighting, joint shipbuilding, mining, exploration was getting underway. Stuff that could have created structures of mutual interest that would have bound North and South Korea closer together. Really foolish to ditch all that, and unbelievably naive to, I mean, I just cannot put myself in the mindset that thought, okay, you know, now you just tell North Korea that they won't get anything unless they give up. They do the one thing that everybody knows they're never going to do, or the last thing they'll ever do, which is to give up nuclear weapons and wait for that to happen. I mean, A, that wasn't going to happen, and B, wasn't it obvious that that would create a huge vacuum which China would fill? And China saw its chance, rushed in, and now has, as I see it, a commanding position in North Korea, having shown its diplomatic support by not criticizing the North over the admittedly controversial still Chonan thing or about the Yeonpyeong shelling. China is in there. It's in there politically, it's in there economically in the Rason zone and the other one near Dandong. And so Lee Myung-bak has blown it. And then, of course, the South Korean electoral cycle kicks in. The president can only serve 5 years. So even whatever they do, they're pretty much a lame duck in their final year. And that's where Lee Myung-bak is coming into. So he may well try already by changing his unification minister finally at the end of August. There have been sort of slight signals. They've let a few more people go north and so on. But, I mean, if I were Kim Jong-un, or if I was Kim Jong-il was still alive for that matter, the North Koreans, having a rather different political system, untroubled by elections, have seen many governments come and go in Seoul as in Washington, have seen on a number of occasions, as when Bush succeeded Clinton, that you thought you had an agreement, and then you actually have somebody come in. You know, it's not always just the North Koreans who break agreements, let's be honest about this. So there's no conceivable merit for Kim Jong-un to trust Lee Myung-bak, knowing that he'll be history in a year from now. What is going to happen, of course, is that all the various contenders for the presidency in South Korea, including in the ruling Conservative Party, are going to try to re-engage with North Korea, not out of sentimentality, but out of sheer geopolitics, to sort of make sure that China has a bit of competition for China. So I don't think that there's much for South Korea to do. I mean, it's quite right for President Lee to say the door is open, and I mean, you know, in his dreams, Kim Jong-un comes down for the nuclear global summit in March and hands over his weapons like Gaddafi. It's not going to happen. I'm sorry, but it just isn't going to happen.
Regardless of whether inter-Korean relations improve in 2012, one thing is for sure. This was supposed to be the year that North Korea became a strong and prosperous nation. To round up, I asked Aidan whether the celebrations would go ahead, given the death of Kim Jong-il.
The thing is, when we often describe North Korea as unpredictable, but then again, sometimes they say that they're going to do things for a year or two in advance. And then, of course, it's quite difficult for them not to. I have long been puzzled by this. I mean, first of all, the fetish for anniversaries and things like that. And also the fact, I mean, strong and prosperous is two-edged, isn't it? I wouldn't have been surprised if they'd emphasized the strong. One, you know, they could say, well, we're, as some of the obituaries for Kim Jong, or the official North Korean accounts have said, well, Kim Jong-il built up North Korea. We're now a powerful nation with nuclear weapons and long-range, launching satellites, of course, as they call it, slightly invisible satellites. And we have nothing to fear. So if they went for the strong pair, enough, but it seems not. I mean, Brian Myers, among others, has emphasized that, no, they really mean the prosperous, as in rich, as in what they patently are not. You could cover the skeleton of the Ryugyong Hotel with glass, and I don't really know who, presumably great expense for somebody, possibly a RASCOM, and it really isn't clear who that will fool. So I thought for a long time, that this is a real hostage to fortune, this strong and prosperous, this Kangsong Taeguk, that it could be a real emperor's clothes moment, and that surely, going back to my point about legitimation crisis, as some small child or adult will, even if they won't blurt it out loud, the fear of being carted off somewhere unpleasant, you know, think, hang on, no, we're not. We're feeble. We're nothing. I mean, it's quite widely known that South Koreans are much richer and that even Chinese are richer and so on. But they're committed to it, so they'll have to go ahead. But it will presumably change its form because what might have been going to happen anyway, I think will now definitely happen. There's got to be some format whereby, the way they're going at the moment, that Kim Jong-un at least formally steps into all the shoes that his father has vacated. So General Secretary of the Party. Might they risk a proper party congress, which they've not had since 1980, maybe? Or chairman of the National Defense Commission? I mean, at the moment, he's not even on the Politburo, unless that's happened today and I've missed it. Nor is he, Kim Jong-un, on the National Defense Commission. So some further enthronements for the young man, assuming he survives till then. And I do think he'll survive till then. I think it will go pear-shaped possibly a bit after that. That seems to be on the cards. It'd be absolutely fascinating to watch.
Well, there you have it. I hope you enjoyed this special on the death of Kim Jong-il and prospects for Kim Jong-un in North Korea. If you enjoyed the podcast, then please do leave us a review. You can do so at our website at kia.podbean.com. Alternatively, you can look us up on iTunes and leave a comment using their feedback system. Well, that's it for today. If you have any suggestions for a future podcast, then please do drop me an email. You can reach me at ocarroll@keia.org. Thanks for listening, and I hope you can join us next time.